Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, Ian Dark and John Rawling. Thank you so much for your generous feedback and your reviews on iTunes. If you haven't yet had the opportunity to review this podcast, please go and give us a 5-star rating if you think we deserve it. This week we are talking about trainers and some of the great coaches we've come into contact with. Ian, let me start with you. What does make a good trainer in the fight game?
Well, I think a great trainer has to be a lot of things rolled into one. I think you've got to be a good strategist at the top level. You've got to devise the right fight strategy for your fighter and be able to communicate with him well enough for him to be able to enact that strategy. But you've also got to understand, I think, too, within that, the limitations of your fighter. Can he do that? Is it wrong to maybe change him from the style that he normally has worked for him? That kind of thing. But you've also got to be something of a psychologist as well. And, you know, what fits one fighter won't fit another one. So the trainer has to be able to read the various fighters in his stable and know the right buttons to press with each one of them. So that's asking quite a lot, all in, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but John, he's right though, isn't he? I mean, Ian, with what Ian's saying, you know, you are strategist, your trainer, your coach, your psychologist, your counselor, your father figure in many ways. It's a 24/7 role for many people, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And I think the most important thing for any trainer, and indeed in any sport, but I think maybe particularly boxing, is to know your man, is to know your fighter, and to actually get on the same wavelength, to be able to connect and get that particular fighter to deliver of his best when it matters. You know, it has to be fun when it matters. It has to be difficult when it counts. And at the same time, as Ian said, in strategy, when it's in a pain, hurt situation, then the trainer has to have the cool head to be able to see a way through and bring the best out of his man. We're talking about trainers here, and we'll talk about some of the greatest names in the sport in our careers, I'm sure. But, you know, I mean, it's a select group, isn't it, who've really succeeded for a long time over the years at this sort of elite level.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because, you know, I've put Brendan Ingalls' name forward for the ballot for the International Boxing Hall of Fame for the last couple of years. I think he's on the ballot due to my recommendation. Not that he shouldn't not just be on the ballot, but be in the Hall of Fame period already. But I think he's one of the he has to be the trainer who has coached more fighters from being raw novices through to champions, because more and more we see these trainers used as hired guns, which I think was a term used for Emmanuel Stewart, whether it was right or wrong. I think that's when it started to come into fashion. But there aren't many, and I think, John, you've sort of hit the nail on the head there, who bring these kids all the way through from, as I say, raw novice right through to championship level. But that's something that Brendan Ingle and now Dominic Ingle in his footsteps have done.
Well, I think Brendan, you know, if you look back over his career, you know, he was a fighter. He came over to Britain from Ireland, I think, back in the 1950s, got himself involved in that gym in an old church hall at the bottom of Newbold Road in Winkerbank in the east end of Sheffield. And he was as much a social worker, I think, as a boxing trainer. You know, he had a remarkable success, and he had people like Harold Graham, like Nazim Hamed, like Johnny Nelson, Ryan Rhodes, you know, and so the list goes on. But it was a lot of these kids went to him when they had pretty much nothing else in their life. And I think repeatedly he saved them, quite possibly from a life of crime. You know, his homespun philosophies went down in boxing history. And when he died, and they gave him a huge funeral come celebration of his life at the lovely cathedral in the centre of Sheffield. You know, I mean, the great and good of the sport came from far and wide just to really doff their cap at somebody who had been a very, very special figure for that city and for all those fighters who came through the gym.
Ian, in terms of Brendan Ingle, he is... It's hard because there's so many great trainers, but in some ways he was a one of a kind, wasn't he? He was a maverick. He was his own man, and he very much left his own legacy.
I can't add much to John's fantastic tribute to him just there as well, but I think he's just honed in on something that's very important. It isn't just about boxing with some of these guys, because I think some of the people who come through the gym doors are not much more than waifs and strays, and probably they'd end up in drug gangs or in prison, some of them. And they're converted into guys who are earning some very decent money and getting their lives sorted out as well. And that's the good news part of boxing. So for me, we shouldn't even be arguing whether Brendan Ingle should be in the Hall of Fame. He should be there right now, especially for the job he did with Johnny Nelson and Harold Graham, and of course Prince Nassim Hamid, who he made into a multi-millionaire. Okay, you know, they split up, but it was all the basics and everything that Brendan taught Naz that made him the superstar that he became. So, you know, I think the sport owes him a great debt. But you can take it on from that, because, you know, Brian Hughes, I think, did a similar job, didn't he, in Manchester? Yeah. I remember him spinning yarns to me when I used to go down there. He said, oh, we used to have Nobby Styles and Brian Kidd in here when they were playing for Manchester United. I said, what, just to watch the boxers? He said, no, they got in the ring. He said, really? So I said, I don't think many modern football managers, I said, Matt Busby must have been in a good mood to let them do that. But that was the kind of place it was, wasn't it? You know, that Colliehurst, Boston, gym. Yeah. You know, so, you know, I loved him as well. You could listen to Brian talk for hours about fighters. So we should put a nod in his direction on this little podcast as well.
You know, you mentioned there about the jail situation and people who could have gone to jail. Brendan used to love to talk about a fighter. I'm sure you've heard this, Triz. A lad called Brian Anderson, who was a very good boxer, got up to British title level. And he said he came in here and he was in a bit of trouble, and it may have kept him out of jail. And he said, look at him now. He's running the jail. He became the chief man at Doncaster Nick.
So they didn't all get rescued then.
It's great. I mean, there were there's a lot of obviously good Brendan Ingle stories. There is one on a recent Boxing Life stories with John Thaxton, who obviously divided his time between Norwich and Sheffield, and he was part of an Ingle gang that went to prison to do the sparring with the prisoners, which you would have heard about. Yeah. With, you know, the prisoners were allowed to strike the fighters, but the fighters weren't allowed to punch back. Well, John goes to prison with Herbie Hyde, and Herbie has it broken down to him. You know, you can't hit the prisoner, but they're allowed to hit you. You've got to do everything you can to get out of the way of the prison. Herbie sort of nods and sort of, you know, looks a bit vacant and stutters his way through and agrees. And then the bell goes, the prisoner walks out, and Herbie chins him.
I'm not surprised.
And he said, I thought he was going to hit me. I mean, John Thaxton tells the story far better than me, but there's some great, great Brendan Ingle stories there. And I'm glad you made that nod to Brian Hughes as well, who obviously, I think it's really crucial when you look at these people and what they did. Obviously, he didn't just train champions like your Robin Reeds and your Pat Barretts, but when you look at where, you know, Pat specifically, where his life might have led him without the influence of someone like a Brian Hughes, it keeps these guys on the straight and narrow. For every champion they've had, there's probably another 100 or 200 or more guys that they've given self-respect, discipline, respect for others to, that they've been able to take with them in life elsewhere and become success stories in life.
Your Herbie Hyde story is a good one, Chris, because he was famous, wasn't he, for beating up his sparring partners. I mean, he used to infuriate the trainers because they'd have to spend a fortune. They were coming in and out of the gym and lasting only about a day or two, most of them. He didn't quite get the idea of how you treated sparring partners, Herbie.
And some of them were high-priced American sparring as well.
Yeah.
They were, flights back, pretty sharpish.
Yeah. Herbie was a funny guy. We turned up in Las Vegas, me and Glenn McCrory, got out of our taxi outside the hotel and to cover his fight against Riddick Bowe. And he was standing on the steps of the hotel as we got out. I don't know if he was going out for a walk or whatever. And we get out and he goes, "What are you two doing here?" I said, "Well, we're covering your fight, Herbie."
Small world. Oh dear. Great stuff. But also, there's one thing I did want to touch upon as well, Ian, and I think you've got a story or two about him. But when you look at these guys, to a man, in terms of the names I've got in front of me that we'll discuss, they're all very personable, friendly and talkative guys, even at the highest level. And I remember once phoning Angelo Dundee for an interview for Boxing News, and with the greatest possible respect, I couldn't get him off the phone. And it was a career high, him just going on about stories I've heard umpteen times, and nor did I want to get him off the phone, but it was a privilege. Yeah. And he was one of the guys that you met first in your foray into boxing, wasn't he? Was he not?
Well, yeah, I mean, his book's a great read. I think it's called "I Only Talk Winning," so I'd recommend that. I mean, buy it now, like all your books, Chris. to cover the old joke, but I mean, the biggest first fight I ever covered was Muhammad Ali against Larry Holmes. So one of the very first people I ever spoke to in boxing was Angelo Dundee, turning up for the first time as a stranger in America and like a wet behind the ears reporter with a tape recorder. And kind of wandering up to him when I probably shouldn't have done in the middle of the training and asking if I could get an interview with Muhammad Ali. And, he stops the training session and says, "We got a guy here from Britain. Let's talk to the guy from Britain." And Ali starts jiving about all this as well. And so I kind of formed a little relationship with him straight away there. Of course, that camp particularly loved everything about Britain, Ali, Angelo Dundee, because the British Boxing Border Control continued to recognize Ali as the champion, even when he was banned for the alleged draft dodging in the United States. So, yeah, I mean, he's got to be there, hasn't he, in any conversation about the great trainers, Muhammad Ali, Sugar Ray Leonard. So, yeah, that's quite a portfolio straight away.
Well, the thing is, as well, it wasn't just his back catalogue, and it wasn't just his influence or his strategy, but obviously he was a motivator, wasn't he? He was "You're blowing it, son," to Ray Leonard, wasn't he?
Yeah, "You're blowing it, kid." That was his line to him after about six, seven rounds of that fight. A famous line spoken in the corner. I mean, you could almost write a book about some of the speeches that trainers have given in corners. So Angelo there, and of course they were faced with that agonizing decision with Ali in that Larry Holmes fight about when to pull him out. I mean, it was pretty clear from a very early point to me that he was a shadow of himself, a shell of himself, and in danger against Larry Holmes. But it went on for 10 sickening rounds, 10 of the hardest rounds I ever watched, in that very first assignment that I had. So I was just wondering what was going through Angelo Dundee's mind there. And that brings another element into this as well. The compassion needed by a trainer in the corner, knowing when is that moment to pull a fighter out of a fight.
Just elaborating on that one, I actually was lucky enough, and I've got a photograph recording this somewhere, which is a real treasured possession. I was lucky enough to sit down and interview Angelo at length. I think it was probably when I was over in America and in Memphis for the Lennox Lewis Mike Tyson fight, and he was around. And I sat down and chatted with him, and it was a beautiful. It was a lovely, lovely interview. And as you say, Ian, I mean, he just touched on everything. He was such a good communicator. And, you know, the nature of radio reporting is that you do these lovely interviews, or at least you did in those days, and they sort of pull a 30-second clip out of it, which goes... And that's it. The rest of it gets lost forever. But he was just an absolute delight. And one of the things I actually asked him about Ali, who incidentally he always referred to right the way through his life as my kid. You know, he was so close to Ali right the way up to the end of Angelo's life. And he lived to be over 90. And Ali was there at his funeral. But I did say to him, you know, Ferdy Pacheco walked away after the Ernie Shavers fight. And Ali went on fighting, 5 years on after that. He was still fighting against Berbick in 5 years on in 1981. What was all that about? Why didn't you tell him, for goodness sake, we can see the damage you're doing to yourself. Get away from it. And his answer was, you could never tell Ali what to do. He said he made his own decisions. He always said, if I had my life to live, I would do it exactly the same way again. He said, if he made a decision, he was going to do something, he would do it. And I honestly think Angelo, you know, having heard that from Ali and having realized that, and he was with him from right way back, right the way through his career, I think he kind of thought, well, if he's going to do this, he needs somebody who loves him and understands him in his corner, which Angelo unquestionably did.
Yeah. There were people in that corner, I think, though, there that night against Larry Holmes, who probably would not want to have looked in the mirror about the way they went on that night. And I'm thinking of Bundini Brown. I think, you know, he couldn't accept that really the story was over and they had to get him out of there. And I think he may have been a bit of an influence. So I may be doing him a disservice there, but that was the story that kind of came out that night in a lot of the fallout. And it was fallout right after that fight. But just before we leave, Angelo, I mean, I don't know whether the story is really broadcastable on this podcast, but let's give it a go. Oh, I mean, he tells that story about Willie Pastrano, who was a very good-looking guy who had a fairly voracious appetite for women. So they had to keep a bit of a close eye on a beautiful boxer, lovely to watch. But on the afternoon of one fight, he's in his room with a waitress or somebody from the hotel, and Angelo's banging at the door and shouting out, "Don't come, Willie!"
So did you hear the title of Pastrano's book?
Go on.
Only Talk Women.
Brilliant. Before we leave it, Howard Cassell was once quoted about Angelo Dundee, you know, Howard Cassell, who is the leading fight commentator in the United States for a couple of decades. And he said, if ever I had a son who I couldn't persuade not to box, he said, if ever I had a son who had to box, the man I would want to look after him would be Angelo Dundee.
Or would it be Eddie Futch, I wonder, John, because you lead us on quite nicely there. I mean, to one of the most famous lines ever spoken by a trainer, you know, at the end of the Thriller in Manila, you know, where he pulls him out of the fight, he pulls Joe Frazier out of the fight and says, sit down, son, it's over, but nobody's ever going to forget what you did here today. You know, huge decision. And of course, Frazier didn't speak to him for a long time afterwards, but that probably goes in at number one as the most sensible, compassionate decision ever taken by any trainer anywhere. What do you think, Tris?
Yeah, well, you know, years later, it was kind of replicated by Johnny Lewis, wasn't it? When he didn't let Kostyuzu out to Ricky Hatton in the last round. Do you know, there was some synergy there. You know, people might sort of say, oh, well, World Heavyweight Championship between two of the great heavyweights, it's a different level. But there were reminders there. But yes, I think you're right in terms of the Eddie Futch thing. But obviously, Eddie worked with so many great fighters. And, you know, there's a lot of fighters he worked with that are under the radar. But the ones over the radar are, you know, your Riddick Bowes and even your Wayne McCulloch's. He did a lot with an assortment of talents.
Crazy. Yeah. Ken Norton, Larry Holmes, Trevor Berbick, Evander Holyfield, Roy Jones Jr. for a while as well. I mean, it's quite a list.
Going back into the mists of time, Eddie used to spar Joe Lewis. Joe used to use him, the Brown Bomber. He used to use him for speed work. So Eddie goes all the way back there. And I remember when I first met him, and you must have sensed all this as well, Ian, when you come across these people, I just felt a sense of absolute reverence, sort of sitting, listening and talking to Eddie Futch, who was in no sense of the word a man with a big ego, but he just had this sort of aura of somebody who'd been around the fight game forever and knew every little wrinkle of what it entailed. And another one who was, remember when George Foreman was making his comeback? He had Archie Moore, didn't he, in the corner? Yeah. And I can remember going up and sort of, I could hardly put two words together to speak to Archie Moore. You know, there's me, the little young reporter from BBC, and this guy who's one of the absolute legends of the sport. And you are sort of humbled to be in the presence of these guys, or at least I was.
Yeah, I think you're right, because coming out of every pore of guys like that who are, I mean, legend is an overused word these days, but they are legends of the sport. And you can feel the wisdom coming out of every pore, can't you?
Absolutely.
I tell you what, though, gents, you know, these guys were trainers when, you know, we were in a different time then. You know, I wasn't even around, but there was, this is when, in inverted commas, men were men and old school practices were commonplace. You know, things that wouldn't cut it in society or in modern gyms. But the where I'm going with this is I'm thinking of George Francis over in this, on this side of the pond, and him sending everyone into the icy bath of on Hampstead Heath to go into the lake and just get, you know, regardless, all year round, I think it was, wasn't it, John, where he would send the guys in. And the thing is, it's character building, right? And I'm sure there were some health benefits. We know about ice baths and what have you now, but it was to build character on the guys, right?
He was a tough man, was George, and he'd have them doing a 9-mile run around Hampstead Heath before, you know, insisting that they all went in the pond, whether it be John Conti, Frank Bruno, whoever it may be, anybody who trained with him would get in that pond. And if they didn't do so, they'd get to the cafe afterwards and he'd refuse to pick up the tab. You know, that was George. But I tell you another really important thing, which doesn't get stressed as much as it probably should be with George, is he goes way back into the 1960s. He was a bare knuckle fighter originally, and Frank Bruno, when he finally worked with him, you know, I mean, he worshipped him, and I know it affected Frank desperately hard when George, at the age of 73 or whatever it was, he took his own life after a succession of family tragedies. But George did a huge amount against racism within British boxing. You know, I mean, two of his early champions, Buddy Johnson and Bunny Sterling. This is at a time when black fighters were not really given too much support within the sport in Britain. And George was one of the first who said, if you're good enough and you want to come in my gym, I do not care what colour you are. And he was terrific for that. And I'm sure that there are those around who, with long memories, who'd remember that and speak very fondly of him for precisely that fact.
Yeah, well, it's a handsome tribute, John, to George. And while we're talking about British trainers, I think we have to talk about Terry Lawless as well, don't we?
Definitely.
Yeah, Maurice Hope, Jim Watt, Frank Bruno, Lloyd Hannigan, John H. Stracey, and Kirkland Lang, Kayla, and people like that. So, you know, I'm missing a few names even then, I'm sure. But, yeah. So, I mean, Terry was always accused, wasn't he, of falling in love with his fighters too much, getting too sentimentally involved with them. But that is an impressive list of champions, isn't it?
So yeah, and he had one or two good people alongside him in that gym, you know, people like Jimmy Tibbs, didn't he?
Yeah.
Who'd come back from his own problems, a guy who'd been a decent fighter, then got caught up in gangland action and wound up in jail, served time for attempted murder. And it was Terry who helped Jimmy rehabilitate himself in the sport, and he was very much a part of that gym.
Yeah.
So Terry Lawless. So I mean, Ian, did you know him quite well? Because
Yeah.
I never got to meet Terry properly. Might
Yes,
send you a
I
couple of
dealt with him a
pictures.
lot when I first covered boxing, because I used to go down. This was in the days when Mickey Duff, Jarvis Astaire, etc., ruled the roost, and just about all their shows were shown on BBC One. So they were often on at the Royal Albert Hall on a Tuesday night. They were shown the next night on Sports Night on the television. I'd be doing the radio reports, sometimes commentaries as well. So yeah, I saw all those fighters. I remember seeing Lloyd Hannigan as an undercard fighter on those shows, and my impression was that he was a bit of a kind of a fancy Dan, really, dancing around the ring, throwing his jabs, and probably he wasn't going to amount to too much. So what did I know? You know, because look what happened to his career, just to pick one. And it was interesting, actually, talking to Jim Watt later on. He said when he went to Lawless's gym, you know, because it was late in his career that they kind of discovered him and decided to nurture him and launch him on a world title campaign. He was down in the gym in Canning Town at the Royal Oak, working out. And he said, I could work out nearly all the people, you know, that they put in front of me down there. He said, but the one guy I had trouble with right from the word go was Lloyd Hannigan. He said, I could tell that guy had a lot going for him. I said, that's interesting because not many people really thought that right at the start of his career.
Yeah, let me ask you this, Ian. I mean, in terms of Terry, you mentioned there obviously about the cartel and their involvement. Was Lawless political in that respect, or was he just trying to get the best deal for his fighters?
I think he was probably just trying to get the best deal for his fighters. Obviously, you know, the Sunday Times ran a big investigation, didn't they? Saying that, you know, and comparing the kind of money some of the fighters were getting on those bills. And it was a very, you know, it was a cozy cartel as it was discovered at the time. And I remember Terry Lawless being so hurt by all of that. He said, he showed me all the books. He invited me out to an Italian restaurant down in the East End of London, and got out the books and showed me how he hadn't received fees. He said, I don't even take a cut from most of my fighters until they get to a sort of certain level in their career. You know, and here are the books. You know, I think he was thinking of quitting at one point about that. You know, there was the famous night where he was going to quit and give it all up for good when Frank Bruno lost to Bone Crusher Smith and Mark Kaler lost to Buster Drayton on the same card. But changed his mind. So, I mean, my impression of him, obviously everybody in boxing has got to make a living. And yes, of course he took advantage of the fact that he was the closest trainer and the main trainer for Mickey Duff. So that was the way they carved it up. I don't know about the financial side of it, but I do know, I think that Terry Lawless genuinely really did love all his fighters.
John, let me ask you this. So Ian touches there upon the finances of it. Obviously, it's known that a trainer gets 10%, right? That's the accepted route. And obviously, there are times when a fighter's starting out and he's on a couple of hundred quid where the trainer might be taking 20 quid. There's obviously a point years down the line where the fighter might be on 10 million
Yeah.
and all of a sudden they're not quite so keen to part with 1 million quid as 10%. And we've seen this fallout many times over the years, haven't we? Where, you
Yeah.
know, despite these guys investing, and I'm not necessarily asking you to name names, but where these guys have invested years, you know, getting up, running early, sacrificing family engagements and all the rest of it, and then they're sort of released at the height of someone's fame. It can be tough, but it's also, I see what some people say, where, you know, well, you know, 1 million quid is a lot for someone to make for 6 weeks, but then, as I sort of touched upon, it's not a 6 week investment. It's a 10, 15, 20 year journey, isn't it? What are
No,
your
I mean,
thoughts on that, John? Circumstances alter cases or what?
the principal example of that, and nobody's going to, get on the phone and sue anybody about this, was Nazim Hamed and Brendan Ingle, wasn't it? I think, and Brendan would talk quite openly about the fact that he deserved the money that he was asking for because of precisely that and didn't get it. And instead, of course, you got Emmanuel Stewart coming in who. Okay, he was a good motivator on the night, and he focused on Naz as a power puncher, but he didn't understand the technique and everything that had gone into him from being the little kid who walked into the gym at 12 years old, son of the guy who owned the newspaper shop just up the road. You know, he didn't know all that. And I'm sure that Brendan would have taken nothing off Naz in those early fights. And then when it came to the big ones, he didn't get what he felt he belonged. And that was at the root of the fallouts. And if you look at fallouts in boxing, in my experience of it, 9 times out of 10, money is at the root of it, whether it be trainers, managers, promoters, or whatever, it's money that talks.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Ian, what's your take on that? I mean, because it's not necessarily a one size fits all argument, isn't it? But sometimes when you get to that 10% thing, and you know, I mentioned 10 million, some of these guys get up to 30, 40, 50 million.
Yeah,
10% of that is exorbitant, isn't it? And then you're talking about, you know, family wealth and family security for generation, you know, generational wealth. I don't know. So it's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah. And then I suppose the fighters, if they do stay with the same trainer, probably come to an agreement where they will pay them a lump sum amount per fight rather than handing over 5 million quid to them. But yes, of course, that does become an issue, doesn't it? For every fighter who makes it big becomes, well, what was an HBO fighter, not anymore, of course, in America, or, you know, a headliner, a Las Vegas big star, that kind of thing. There are bound to be ructions and splits, and money undoubtedly is at the heart of it. I don't think that'll ever change either, really, to be honest with you, because, you know, all kinds of other people start to get involved as well who want a slice of the action, don't they?
Well, one guy who did endure was, for the most part, was Ronnie Davis in his work with Chris Eubank, John, wasn't it? And Ronnie was the charismatic Brighton ex-fighter, tough man, no nonsense. Although him and Chris had a pretty special relationship, didn't they?
Well, I absolutely hold my hands up and say, of all the trainers who I've come across over the years, I think I like Ronnie as much as any. He's a genuinely, genuinely funny man. And yeah, the relationship that he had with Chris, it absolutely worked, didn't he? You know, Chris would regard him almost as a servant in some ways. He'd ring him at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it wouldn't sort of, oh, sorry to bother you, Ronnie. He'd pick the phone up and he'd say, David, what time are we training tomorrow? You know, something like that. You know, and he'd just expect Ronnie to be there at his beck and call 24/7. And as well as that, you know, he'd seemingly, when you watch them work out together, he'd seemingly just completely ignore what Ronnie was saying. He'd treat him with almost with disdain. But people who were there who maybe understood a little bit more, they used to say, well, Chris gives the impression of not listening. And maybe you only say 3 or 4 words during the course of a session, 3 or 4 words which really stick, but he takes it on board and he does listen to you a lot more than you imagine. And I think that it was that relationship, the two of them, yeah, kind of understood each other, which goes right the way back to what Ian and I have said absolutely at the beginning, Triz, that, you know, the key to a fighter is to understand your man. And I think Ronnie understood Chris's eccentricities and certainly got the very best out of him.
Well, I think it's chemistry, isn't it? That's the word. There's a chemistry between Ronnie Davis and Chris Eubank. But let's face it, Chris wouldn't have been the easiest guy to train, would he? He's got his own way of going about everything. But Ronnie Davis was clever enough, amid all his humour, to know exactly the right way to be around Chris Eubank. I mean, to underline the point you made, John, about him regarding as a servant, I mean, I heard him a couple of times call him Porter. Porter, I will need my bags delivered right away. I mean, it was hilarious. And Ronnie laughed at it all himself as well. He never took any offence. And I think, you know, let's be honest about it. You know, Ronnie enjoyed the ride too, didn't he? With you,
absolutely.
They had a fabulous time and made good money and you know, great for Chris and for Ronnie for that.
But also, let's not forget as well that Ronnie, when the going got tough, he wasn't afraid to put his neck out, because he cracked Eubank with some proper slaps in the corner, didn't he? A couple of times, didn't he? Some gunshots went off in there. You guys would have both seen that, right?
Yeah.
Some of the biggest shots Chris took, weren't they?
Yeah.
So he wasn't afraid. I mean, you compare that relationship, say, to the one as we move on through our little hall of fame of trainers here, to sort of Billy Graham's relationship with Ricky Hatton. I mean, those two were like mates, weren't they? You know, that was really sad when that broke up for me, because they were like soul brothers.
Yeah, and you didn't ever anticipate that really coming to the end, and the way it did was all messy and, you know, outside interferences, I think, and outside forces, which was a real shame. And like you said, really, they sort of captured the imagination together, because they were part of that era. It was quite funny, because I was about to say, imagine if Ronnie Davis and Chris Eubank had had their own reality TV show. Well, in many ways, 24/7 was a Billy Graham, Ricky Hatton reality TV show, wasn't it? You know, because,
yeah.
I mean, they were played off against the Mayweathers or whoever it was at the time. But that chemistry was so, so special, wasn't it, between Billy and Ricky, John?
And it caught the imagination of the Manchester public, didn't it? Just amazingly so. They were the archetypal, and I don't mean to sound in any sense, you know, sort of clash conscious or condescending, but they were the archetypal working class heroes. The whole of Manchester, particularly that Hyde side of Manchester, they all felt as though they were part of the camp, that these guys were them, that they were alongside them, and they so much identified with Billy and Ricky. It was amazing. I don't think I've ever quite seen a fighter, certainly in the UK, capture public imagination in the way that Billy and Ricky did.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing, don't underestimate too how good he was strategically. That was a very fine plan that they devised that night for the Costa Zoo fight, because they worked out to get into a sort of close range where you wouldn't have the proper leverage for his punches. They kind of closed him down and worked in zones that probably just reduced his effectiveness. So, you know, I was told about this strategy afterwards, and when you look back at the tape of the fight, Ricky did that very, very well amid all his huge adrenaline that night. I mean, I think we've said before on these podcasts, I don't think anything was going to stop him that night. But it was a good strategy that Billy came up with.
For both of them, it was their greatest night, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
You know, you look at both their careers, they were never better than they were that night in the Manchester Arena in 2005.
I don't know. I mean, why did they fall apart? I mean, my memory maybe is starting to serve me badly here, but was that a financial thing or what
so
was it?
I think Billy had some financial gripes, but also he was saying about his hands being injured and not wanting to take and not standing up to the abuse. And I think then Ricky ran with that side of things, and it was just messy. It became a he said, she said thing, which wound up in court and was not pleasant. But we did talk about Emmanuel Stewart, by the way, briefly beforehand.
Yeah.
And obviously we talked about him maybe as a hired gun, but then you do look at the work he did with, you know, obviously, you know, Kenty and Hearns and all the Detroit lot, but then his reclamation projects with the likes of Lennox and Vladimir, it was outstanding, because he didn't just rebuild fighters. He rebuilt mindsets, didn't he?
He had great respect, didn't he, from the people who he worked with. I think Lennox respected Emmanuel and connected with Emmanuel in a way that he didn't in any sense with his trainers before that. And likewise, Vladimir. I mean, he absolutely turned Vladimir around, didn't he? I mean, he was a fragile fighter, Klitschko. Mm. And yet under the tutelage of Emmanuel Stewart, he became probably by a distance eventually the best fighter in the world, and it was Emmanuel who absolutely should be credited with that. And you know, he touched on something with Lennox, didn't he? They got on with each other tremendously well. Emmanuel, and again, I'm not saying anything out of turn here, he was to put it mildly a little bit of a ladies' man, and Lennox, who, remember, not too many years before, people had asked the question fairly openly, Is Lennox a man's man? Is he gay? Well, of course, Lennox was a long way from that. And I think that being part of the company of Emmanuel Stewart, I think he felt very comfortable in that very heterosexual atmosphere. And Manny and Lennox were a very special team together.
Yeah, I mean, he was a boxing genius, really, I think, wasn't he? I think there was, you know, I think John's got it right. There was a reverence among the fight community for Manny Stewart. He did become a little bit of a hired gun maybe later on in his training career. He was turning up in all kinds of corners, but he was clever. He could work out a strategy for a fight. He knew how to maximize the talents any given fighter had and to maybe hide some of their weaknesses as well. Very, very clever. I'm not sure he was ever really that much in love with the British media. You know, I caught him off guard one day. We were just standing and I heard him talking to somebody else in the camp saying, and he said, "Oh, I've got to go and sit around for half an hour with those," I won't use the word, "British reporters." Like, he wasn't relishing the experience. So I don't know, you know, maybe he was just in a bad mood that day. But I mean, take as you find. He was always helpful enough with me every time I spoke to him. I'm sure John the same as well. So even if he didn't enjoy having to talk to the British media, he did it anyway.
Well, I mean, Emmanuel had great reverence for Boxing News. I know that at least. He would get two copies every week and he would have one for the house and one for the gym. And he loved it. And I remember phoning him up because he did a column for me for Boxing News for a while. And I remember phoning him up once early on in our relationship. And he was in an HBO fighter meeting. And I called him up and I said, "Oh, man, have you got a few minutes? I just want to talk about the fight this weekend." And he said, "Oh, I'm just in an HBO production meeting." And I was expecting to say, "Can you phone back in 10 minutes? And I heard him shout to the guys, "Guys, I've got Boxing News on the phone. I'll be back in 5 minutes." Yeah. And he left the production meeting and came and spoke to us. And I knew he always had great reverence for Boxing News as a publication.
Tris, just continuing on that story. Do you remember, I don't know if you're aware of this, but one of your predecessors, Harry Mullen, got into trouble with Barney Eastwood. He wrote something in Boxing News, which was construed as libelous. And the court action came down in Barney Eastwood's favour. And it was going to cost Boxing News something in the region of £30,000 to even continue. And the parlous state of the paper's finances in those days, there was a very real chance that it was going to go to the wall. And what Emmanuel did, he offered and paid his own way, took no expenses. He came across the Atlantic and they organized a big dinner. And Emmanuel was the star speaker and they made quite a lot of money, in fact, a serious amount of money out of that dinner. And it was Emmanuel's love of Boxing News there, in a way, maybe directly, maybe indirectly, he saved the paper.
Wow, that is a great story. I mean, of course, it was Tommy Hearns, wasn't it? The hitman who really made his reputation as a big-time trainer, you know, knocking people out. I mean, the job he did with Hearns was interesting because Hearns wasn't really a puncher, was he, as an amateur? I think he's a very slender knockout record in the amateurs, but he became this ferocious hitman, literally, in the professionals. So the job that they did with him was interesting.
Did you ever go to Kronk, guys? Because I mean, it was an amazing experience, wasn't it?
Oh God, the Kronk gym. I've got a story about that. We were there one day doing some filming, and I went outside to record this piece to camera outside the Kronk gym afterwards. And there was some technical problem. I've been standing there for about 10 minutes waiting to film it, and some of the guys started coming out of the gym, and they goes, "What are you doing waiting around here?" And I said, "Well, we're just waiting to shoot this piece." He goes, "You might get shot another way if you hang around much longer." What do you mean? I said, what do you mean we're standing outside the gym? He goes, and they said, pointed to these tower blocks in the distance. He goes, "Guys like you, I mean," he goes, dressed in a suit and tie, because all these posh cameras, goes, "Somebody's going to take a pot shot at you." I mean, this is Detroit. So I said, I turned around and said to the producer, "I'll tell you what, let's do this shoot somewhere else."
I knew all it was in a serious neighborhood, Kronk. I mean, there were burned out houses and major turf wars taking place. And I remember coming out, having been downstairs in the cellar where all the boxing took place, and I got outside and I saw this fabulous red convertible Rolls-Royce Corniche. And I looked at it, and the top was down, sitting outside the gym. And I remember saying to somebody, I said, "Who's that? I mean, that's somebody who's pretty brave or connected, isn't it? Parking that there." And he said, "Oh, that belongs to Emmanuel. Nobody's going to touch that."
Nobody was going to touch. I mean, it was the murder capital of America, Detroit, wasn't it? I remember getting a cab from the airport there one day. We were doing a fight at the Cobo Hall. I think it was Dennis Andrews and Tommy Hearns. And I was just sort of having that idle chat, as you do with the cab driver. And I said, "Oh, isn't it?" I said, I just read in the paper that Detroit isn't the murder capital anymore of the USA. It's gone down to number two. Houston's gone to number one, or St. Louis or something." He seemed quite hurt. He goes, "What do you mean?" He goes, "We had four critical last night." Well, what do you mean we're not number one?
Oh, geez.
I mean, it was a pretty edgy, dangerous place. Detroit, if you went to the wrong areas.
That's great. And then with regards to Emmanuel, obviously his legacy now lives on in the shape of some of the top trainers around today, and Andy Lee, Sugar Hill, Jonathan Banks and Joey Gamache, who are all training top guys and have their own stables and all have those Kronk ties. There might be a couple more there as well. But in terms of guys that did cut their own paths, there wasn't anyone probably as individual that I've met in this entire sport as Enzo Calzaghe. He was an absolute one of a kind in every way, shape or form. And, how he did what he did with Joe and how Joe did what he did with Enzo, I'll never know, because it's one of the most incredible stories in boxing history, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's a brilliant story, isn't it? You know, Enzo and playing his guitar and singing his songs, but it turned out he knew a fair bit about how to handle a fighter. And that relationship, that father-son thing with Joe, I bet there were all kinds of people trying to muscle in, thinking, "Look at Calzaghe's talent. We've got to get him with a top trainer, one of the big names." But that never happened, did it? Joe was never going to turn his back on his dad, and his dad guided him every step of the way, and they hardly missed a beat, did they? When you look at it, he retired unbeaten and passed all the tests with flying colours.
There were well-placed people, Ian, who said, you remember when Joe was getting all his hand injuries, which often happens with people who are fairly heavy-handed, which Joe was. There were people saying, "Oh, Enzo doesn't know how to bind hands. What does he know about it? He's never been in a ring. You watch him on the pads and he pushes the pads out against the fighter rather than letting the fighter dictate the terms of where they're going." And all sorts of things which people were criticising him technically as a trainer. And some of it may have been right. But the most important thing, it's going back to what we said about Angelo Dundee, to what we said about Ronnie Davis and so many others. He knew, when it came down to it, what made Joe tick. Joe knew it, Enzo knew it, and that's why it worked.
And it never felt the same getting in the ring without his dad in the corner, would he?
No, not
at all. I think it's too easy also to forget here that Enzo didn't just have Joe, but he had Enzo Macconelli, Gavin Rees and Nathan Cleverley as three other world champions. And then he had the likes of Bradley Price and other guys that were on the peripheries at championship level. For a very short period of time, his stable was incredible. And you talk about success breeding success. And most of the guys we've mentioned have had purple patches where they, their guys seem unstoppable. But Enzo did a lot more than just Joe. But obviously it's Joe and their stories together that we all remember through the years, isn't it, really, John? And like you said, the ties that bind.
Yeah, I mean, you talk to Enzo Macronelli about those days and he can be absolutely achingly funny talking about the effing and blinding that would go on and how they'd have huge fallouts. And then at the end of the session, they'd be hugging and kissing as though nothing had ever happened, as though nothing had gone wrong. They had an amazing bond. And I think when Enzo, pretty unexpectedly died at the relatively young age of, what was he, 68, Joe found it very, very difficult to come to terms without his dad. You know, I mean, you have your children, you have women in your life, you have other people in your life. But I think the love of Joe's life and the man who he truly respected, despite all his bonkers behaviour on occasion, was his dad Enzo, who was an absolute one-off. And with his son, he was an absolute genius.
There are so many people who've crossed our paths covering this sport over the years and who you think back fondly of, like Ernie Fossey and Denny Mancini. You're no longer with us, but they were warm characters who just oozed boxing, and it was an education always to talk to them, wasn't it? I mean, Ernie was Frank Warren's right-hand man, wasn't he, as a trainer through all those early years when Frank was establishing himself as a promoter, when he had, like, Keith Wallace, on every bill, by the sound of things, by the look of things, around that time. So, yeah, I remember Ernie very fondly. I've still got the sort of the hymn service for his funeral.
Yeah, and then...
I better not embarrass the memory of Ernie by naming names here, but I remember once sitting at ringside, and he was the matchmaker, Triz, and knew everything about all these fighters. And I remember he was sitting next to me, and the given fighter was having life and death against somebody who really he should have been beating comfortably. And I remember Ernie saying, "Fuck me, look at him, calls himself a champion. You can't fucking miss him."
I remember him telling me off about one of my radio commentaries once. He said, "Oh yeah," he said, I was listening to you on the radio last night. He said, "I quite enjoyed it." He goes, "But you said at one point he threw a left hook like a gunslinger." He goes, "Gunslingers don't throw left hooks, they shoot guns."
You can't tell any straighter than that, Ian. Blimey. I like it. And I suppose we'd be remiss, as long as we're mentioning these guys, to not mention Dean Powell, who I remember, Dean and I would talk a lot. We were sort of in prime positions where he was one of the guys I would speak to regularly and obviously see at the fights. And I actually do remember I'd written a piece on depression and mental health before it became acknowledged as a bit of a pandemic in boxing. And I remember that piece really hit home with Dean. And a few weeks later, sadly, Dean was gone. But he is a British boxing stalwart and definitely deserves to be mentioned in these conversations. And John, I'm sure you have many memories of Dean, right?
Oh, so much time for Dean. I mean, it hit all of us very hard, didn't it, when he took his own life. And that that funeral down in Greenwich was one of the, bleakest and most difficult of deaths that I think boxing in recent years has had to come to terms with. But his knowledge of the boxing game was so encyclopedic, wasn't it? Before you were covering a fight, and at that time, I guess I'd have been working for ITV and Satanta principally, covering all the big Frank Warren promotions. And in the run-up to the fight, I'd always have a chat with Dean, who'd mark my card on the fight coming up and the strengths and weaknesses of the contests and those involved in them. He was so generous. And you say you wrote a piece which hit home, Triz, but having talked to him, I just couldn't understand it when it happened. As somebody who just knew him through boxing and having a laugh and a chuckle at ringside and around the hotel in the run up to fights, I have to say, I simply did not see it coming.
And of course, one of my memories of Dean, an abiding memory, is he had Michael Caine on his answering machine, didn't he? Do you remember that? instead of saying, "Hi, this is Dean," or whatever, you were only supposed to blow the bloody doors off, wasn't it? That was his voicemail.
At the funeral, people turned up in Mini Coopers, didn't they, and on scooters. Because he was always a real mod, was Dean Powell, and that was kind of a nice side of it, a kind of an enduring tribute to the lighter side of the man.
Yeah,
he was a warm, jokey kind of guy. So it really was very, very hard to understand, wasn't it?
I suppose I'd be remiss not to mention this here, because you've talked about Dean's funeral, and I was at Enzo Calzaghe's funeral, and that was one of my most brutal days covering the sport and being involved in it, in the sense that, like you said, John, really, it was just a tragically sad day. And some days you might get a funeral where it's a celebration of life, and, you know, and there's a few happy anecdotes and stuff. And some days they just are just so sad. And Enzo's was very much in that one. And it was it was really, really sad. And I remember, you know, I've been friendly with Joe for years. I remember, you know, he was a pallbearer, and, you know, we didn't even make eye contact. He was in his own world, and it was so sad. But then these guys mean so much to people, and this is kind of where we started off the podcast, where they wear so many different hats. And I suppose one of those guys as well, Ian, and I know you've got plenty of stories about him, is Teddy Atlas. And we talked about Mickey Duff earlier.
Yeah.
And I think there was a point where Mickey Duff wanted Teddy to train all his guys, and I don't think they ever got a deal over the line to make it happen. But Teddy Atlas is a jack of all trades. He has the old school sort of customato upbringing with a slightly new slant, but also a guy who is happy to not only read the riot act in the corner, but steal the show if needs be.
Well, he stole the show, didn't he? You know, in the Churchillian speech in the corner of Michael Moore the day he beat Evander Holyfield. And I think Teddy Atlas probably won that fight as much as Michael Moore did, because Moore had that very confused mind. He had plenty of talent, but didn't always apply it. And Atlas's between the rounds soliloquies were, well, we just shut up. We never spoke at all on the commentary. We just let him do the talking and let everybody listen at home to them, because it was just genius stuff. Like, well, there comes a time in a man's life when he's got to decide, is he going to go out there and perform? Is he going to achieve everything he can achieve? Or is he going to walk away down a path where nobody's ever going to notice him again? Well, what's he going to be, Michael? It was that sort of stuff. And he found some new line to spark him between every round. So that probably was the greatest bit of in-corner work I've ever heard.
Yeah, and John, it goes back to where you started, in the sense of you've got to know your guy, you've got to know what buttons to push. And I suppose we touched upon it briefly with Ronnie Davis. He knew that not only could he get away with a smack to Chris Eubank, but that it might trigger the right response. And sometimes you've got, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, is it? Some guys might need a smack, some guys might need a pep talk, some guys might need an arm around them to send them back out and to do the job.
Yeah, I don't think a slap across Michael Moore's face would have been what was required. I don't think it would have been a very good idea, because you'd have got a slap back a damn sight harder. But, you know, for Chris Eubank, who Rob would say afterwards, he said, people don't realise, don't understand what a hard man he is. To actually do that is the sort of thing which maybe at that time would get Chris Eubank's attention, because nobody else would dare to do a thing like that. And Michael Moore, who was the confused, difficult, surly guy who people found so awkward to communicate with. I mean, as an interviewee, Michael Moore was horrific. But on that night, the man who really knew him, who was Teddy Atlas, found the words to spark him and to get what was needed out of him. And that's, I think the bottom line of any trainer is that's the most important thing. You've got to be able to communicate with your man.
I think Michael Moore, you just reminded me of a story about him being very difficult with the media. I think probably the most bizarre press conference I ever covered was Michael Moore walked in and sat down and nobody said anything. He didn't say anything. Nobody introduced the press conference. The reporters sat there, and eventually, after about a minute and a half, Michael Moore pulled out a packet of mints out of his pocket and goes, anyone want a mint? And that was It was surreal. But you know, I'm just thinking about trainers. We're going to miss people out, aren't we? And sorry for anyone who should be mentioned on this, because we're trying to cover a lot of time. But you know, I'm thinking of trainers who definitely had their moments, like, you know, Chris Sanagar taking Glenn Catley. Do you remember that? To the WBC super middleweight title. Sanagar, a great entertainer as a fighter, you know. And what about Jim McDonnell, who got his fighters fitter than anybody ever with his different regimes. I mean, I think he was in the corner when Danny Williams beat Mike Tyson. And we haven't spoken about Freddie Roach yet, have we?
Who was Eddie Futcher's protege, wasn't he? Futcher had been his trainer, and I think he absorbed so much out of Freddie, you know, sort of like a sponge. I mean, out of Eddie. And Freddie, you know, look at the people he's had: Manny Pacquiao, Cotto, James Toney, Virgil Hill, who I think was his first champion, Steve Collins, of course. You know, I mean, it's an amazing run of success he's had.
Amir Khan.
Yeah, Amir Khan, and all done, for the most part, through his career as a trainer, while he's been having to cope with Parkinson's disease. I mean, it's extraordinary what Freddie's done.
It really is, yeah.
There's some great stuff. Go on.
No, I was just going to say, he's a great trainer. He's got to be in the conversation, isn't he, about the modern greats.
Yeah, we're lucky now in this country that we have a host of leading trainers. For a long time, it was, you know, you'll know this both, gents, because it was probably during the 90s, really, when it was thought that to further education, you probably had to go and either get an American trainer or certainly at the very least go and get American sparring. And they were sort of two things. But now we've got the likes of Shane McGuigan, Rob McCracken, Joe Gallagher, Tony Sims, Adam Booth. We're in pretty rude health with our own coaches and with all their respective stables as well.
Jamie Moore's
you'll remember him as well, was Ken Squires, who used to train Tony Simpson. And I remember him saying to me once, I did an interview with him, I said, how do you know when you've got Tony kind of nearly ready to fight? He goes, when he knocks me out in the gym. I said, what? He goes, often he'll miss the pads and he'll catch me and I can feel it. He goes, well, I said, when you're on the floor? He said, yeah. He goes, I was unconscious for a few minutes the other day. But I know he's ready now. He said, and now I've taken, I said, what else? I said, what else has he been doing? He goes, we've chopped down some trees. I've had him chopping down trees. I said, what? Locally? He goes, yeah, we've cleared a spinney down the road. Are you allowed to hear the spinny? He goes, don't worry about that. Nobody's going to argue in Syston, which was, you know, the area north of Leicester where he used to train. I mean, he was a hoot, wasn't he, John?
He certainly was. It was two who worked together, didn't it? You know, I don't think Tony was a kind of a simple country lad, and he found a man in Ken Squires who could just work with him, and they made each other laugh. They had a great time, and they remained friends for all the years that followed.
As you said, guys, we're not going to get round to all these guys. There's also the likes of Lou Duver, Kevin Rooney, and obviously over here as well, John, you mentioned Jamie Moore. There's also Peter Fury. So there's a whole host of guys that we haven't had time. So we'll have to do a trainers part two, I think. This has been a very rich stomping ground of great content and stories, gents. So great success. But guys, it's been nice to see you both. Really appreciate you all for listening. If you can rate and review this podcast on iTunes or where you listen to it, that would be hugely appreciated by myself and the guys. And we will be back next week.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.